The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Is at what point do the actions of the non-state actors allow me to take action against a state sponsor of those actions, and what actions can I take? Because I think that's where I'm going to get the question. And the more I thought about it, the more I think that's going to be the hard problem, and it's going to be related to attribution. So attribution, we talk about that a lot in the cyber realm, but I think in the broader hybrid conflicts, it may more and more come to pass. When is a non-state actor, whether it's a ship taking a particular action or a boat in the middle of the South China Sea, you know, testing another country's claims, and it looks like a commercial vessel. It looks like, you know, a ship that might be flagged in a particular state, but certainly isn't a military vessel or a state vessel. At what point does that fishing trawler's actions can I attribute to the state itself? And that, I think that'll play out in the Ukraine. I think it'll play out in Syria with Yemen and some of the things that are going on there and so forth. It's always going to be a question of what gets attributed back to a state.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 19th, 2015. That was Brigadier General Richard Gross, the legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Last week, Ben attended a symposium at the Pentagon on the rise of so-called hybrid conflicts, where professionals from around the national security establishment attempted to define the idea, as well as its implications for existing legal structures and the law of war. In this week's podcast, General Gross explains that the DoD's senior leadership has increasingly begun to discuss conflicts such as Ukraine, Syria, and the South China Sea in terms of hybrid conflict. And he and Ben explore what lawyers should do with the idea, asking, is it really new, and should the law adjust to deal with it? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 139, Richard Gross on the Law of Hybrid Conflict.
So tell us about this. We just had a 1.5-day conference, a first of its kind. Tell us a little bit about this symposium.
Well, first of all, first of its kind for our office, I should say. You know, and I spoke one of your earlier podcasts along to actually at the very beginning of my term as the chairman's legal, that our office does triage. I mean, we are in the thick of operations. We provide advice to the chairman and provide advice to the joint staff. So one of my talented attorneys, Commander Mike Adams, came to me and said, I'd like to put on a legal symposium, and originally was thinking urban warfare because it's something we all face. And I said, you know, Mike, we don't do symposia. We don't do conferences. We move the actions along and make sure the joint staff and the chairman are prepared to go from one challenge to the next. Do we have the bandwidth? Do we have the time? He assured me he would make the time. And so I said, let's do it. And we started with urban warfare, but as we were delving into that a little bit and he was looking into it, we discovered that our clients were asking questions and talking about and writing about this concept they call hybrid conflict or hybrid warfare. And then it appeared in the recently published Chairman's National Military Strategy that just came out this summer of 2015. And there are parts in it about this new, and I put that in quotes, concept of hybrid conflicts. And so we thought that'd be a great topic to have. Let's have a legal symposium. If we're going to have it on anything, let's have it on a topic that's being talked about and written about by our clients. Certainly there could have been others, but that one seemed to be one that resonated.
So let's talk about this concept. What is what is a hybrid conflict? Why are the clients, you know, asking for guidance on it?
Well, if you think about a Venn diagram, on one big circle, you have state conflict, where you have, you know, large-scale conventional military forces and technologies at play. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have non-state conflict, where you have non-state actors and the use of asymmetric systems and asymmetric warfare. And then where those two circles come together in the middle, there's this blend of conventional and irregular forces where a state is creating ambiguity, seizing the initiative, and trying to paralyze the adversary through the use of both traditional military and asymmetric systems. So some writers will point to the situation going on in the Ukraine and the Crimea. Some writers will point to the South China Sea and the multiple state and non-state actors working there as hybrid conflict.
And what when you get asked as a lawyer about hybrid conflict, that doesn't map on in any neat way to our traditional, particularly international legal regimes of international armed conflict and non-international conflict. How do you react to the idea of hybrid conflict? I mean, partly you reacted by putting on a conference about it, but I mean, is this an area in which you have real views, or is it an area where you're kind of confused and looking around for stuff?
No, it's a good question. We, you know, how we react to it's not new. We would react to it the same way we would in several areas where the client, the commanders, the chairman, the combatant commands, the for the DOD, the Secretary of Defense, and others, you know, when they never talk in the terms we do. We talk about international armed conflict and non-international armed conflict because those are the legal schemes, the legal frameworks that we use to identify what laws, what international norms, and so forth apply to those kinds of conflicts. Clients don't call them NIACs and IACs. Clients talk about counterinsurgency. Clients talk about counterterrorism, civil war, internal armed conflict, guerrilla warfare, state-on-state conflict, et cetera, et cetera. They don't use our terms. And so when we are asked a question about use of force or detention or some other concept in a counterinsurgency, then we take counterinsurgency, the facts on the ground, and we translate it and say, all right, what do we really have? We really have a NIAC. We have a non-international armed conflict. So we apply that law and policy. Obviously, we take what U.S. policy applies as well, and domestic law and other things. But we take that framework now and put it back over counterinsurgency or counterterrorism or whatever we've been asked about. I think it's going to be the same with hybrid conflict. If a client, a commander, a chairman comes to a legal advisor and says, all right, what law applies in this hybrid conflict where I have a state and a non-state actors, the state is behind the scenes, they're running the show, there's a combination of conventional and non-conventional, then I'm going to have to break down the facts on the ground as the legal advisor and say, all right, this situation here to me looks like international armed conflict, state on state, here's the law that applies. And then over here is a non-international armed conflict, and we're going to apply this framework or this set of laws. And it's not going to be unusual, I think, as we've seen in numerous conflicts going on right now, to have multiple conflicts happening at the same time, and we're going to have to overlay those and look at them all.
So when you look at, there were some examples that your staff described in at one point, I'm respecting the Chatham House rules element of the conference, but at one point I asked for examples of what hybrid conflict looked like that challenged paradigms that we've assumed and worked with for a while. What are some of the ones that you've experienced that, you know, have in your triage come up and you've said, I don't know what I'm looking at here?
Well, I never admit to the client. I don't know what I'm looking at. But, you know, certainly I'm saying it to myself. Some of the examples that came up in the conference, that certainly many of which we've discussed here on the joint staff, both within my office internally and then externally to the chairman and the joint staff. You know, if you think about Ukraine, you think about Syria, you think about the South China Sea, one that we haven't necessarily talked about here on the joint staff, but that has come up. The Gaza and the conflict there in Israel, cyberspace, the recent events we've seen there. Cyber is one of those it's hard to use the word classic with a new label that right, our clients are using. Hybrid conflicts are two, but cyber may be the classic hybrid conflict where states are using non-state actors, hackers, computer experts to do their dirty work, if you will. In the domain of cyber. So that may be what becomes one of the hybrid conflict classic examples.
So when you, just to flesh that example out a little bit, you're confronted by a pattern of a cyber intrusion. You don't know who's behind it. You don't know, or maybe you do know who's behind it, but you don't know what state they may be working for, or you may not know for sure. You don't know whether it's an intrusion for espionage purposes or an attack in some actual military sense. How do you know what law to apply?
Well, that's tough. You start with the facts. You gather as much intelligence as you can. I mean, the clients, I keep saying the clients, the joint staff, the commanders, the intelligence community, and others will have facts or what they believe they know from intelligence analysis about what actors are doing it, what was done, where it emanated from, what other countries it went through, what tools were used, et cetera. And you may have a clear picture, but most of the time, my experience has been you don't have a clear picture, and so you don't know. And so you take those and then you begin the analysis. And often you're probably not talking about armed conflict in the first place. You know, the kind of the Talon manual definition, at least for cyber, of what constitutes the equivalent of an armed attack that would merit an appropriate response in cyber is something that actually causes physical damage or harm. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion and, frankly, argument over that. In the cyber domain, you know, if I just steal data, even if it's millions of individuals' social security numbers and financial histories, is there any physical damage? If I take a movie company's files and shut down their computers and reveal their private emails to the world, is that physical damage? And you know, most commentators, at least for that one in particular, said, no, it's not. And so, and therefore, under at least as we currently understand the law, that may not be an armed conflict. And therefore, there's no response. And then, of course, you also add the fact that that was an event that occurred against a private corporation as opposed to a multinational corporation, which further compounds the difficulty of the problem, the complexity. So it's not like it was a government facility or a government computer system, and so you have to take that, I think, into account as well.
So you put together quite an event on this, or Mike Adams did.
I've
never been to a conference at the Pentagon before, and I confess it's not the most convenient place.
It's not at all.
You brought together an amazing group of people to discuss this. Tell us a little bit about the conference and who was here and, you know, kind of who spoke at this symposium.
Yeah, I was frankly surprised, but pleasantly surprised at the overwhelming response we got to it. I really thought that between the short duration of the conference, and we called it a symposium because we wanted to encourage that dialogue, and I think we got that. But the fact that it was only a day and a half, the fact that it's inside the Pentagon, which makes it inconvenient for folks. We had to have escorts for people who, you know, didn't have a government badge to get in. And then the topic, which was, you know, granted, a lot of folks had never heard of it. I think a lot of, as we heard from some of the speakers and some of the offline conversations, people actually went out and Googled hybrid conflicts just to see if it was a topic they wanted to hear about. And yet we were overwhelmed at the response. We had to turn people down and say we just don't have the room because we didn't have a facility large enough, frankly. But we had some of our senior legal advisors from a number of countries that came, allies countries that came, some quite a distance, I mean, overseas flights. We had senior DOD and interagency lawyers, and in many cases, the general counsel of an agency came.
At least three or four.
Yeah, and just, you know, extraordinarily busy people. And then we had a number of really respected law professors from you know, places like Yale, Columbia Law School, American University, and others. Just, you know, again, gratifying that folks would take the time and the expense to come to this. And we didn't offer CLE credit even. I mean, it was great. And I think it was a testament to the program Mike Adams put together. The panels were very frank. We used the Chatham House rules, as you know, which is why I'm not saying anybody specifically by name who was there, nor quoting anybody. But it allowed a really a candid dialogue. We had to keep it unclassified, and you know, there's always a trade-off there. The benefit to that, obviously, is you can have outside folks like yourself who do the deep thinking about these issues, and we need that. We appreciate that because we don't have the time on the joint staff to do the deep thinking and thought because things are moving so fast all the time. So unclassified means you can bring in the big thinkers, but it also means that you can't, if you had it purely classified, then you could keep it to a government-only level, and you could delve more into the classified intelligence, real-world examples, particularly in areas like cyber and so forth, where you could get into that. I think we made the right call, keeping it unclassified, keeping a broader audience. It certainly was a lot of fun, and just some great discussion. I learned a lot. I learned an awful lot in a day and a half.
So is this a... Well, before I get to that, what did you learn? I mean, how do you think about the subject differently than you did a day and a half ago?
Yeah, the first thing, you know, I think one of the things I started thinking about, and I teed that up I can certainly quote myself. I teed up as a question that I wanted folks to think about that I thought as a practitioner I was going to get in the area of hybrid conflicts. Is at what point do the actions of the non-state actors allow me to take action against a state sponsor of those actions, and what actions can I take? Because I think that's where I'm going to get the questions. Not if a state acts, can I act back against them? Because I know how that works.
Right.
And if a non-state actor acts, what actions can I? We deal with that every day. It's the gray space in the middle. It's the, when can I go after the state sponsor of the activity? And the more I thought about it, the more I think that's going to be the hard problem, and it's going to be related to attribution. We talk about attribution a lot in the cyber realm because it's a particularly difficult problem. How do you attribute to a cyber actor and determine if there's a state sponsor, and if so, who that state sponsor is, and so forth? What countries were winning to it, what countries allowed their territory, their servers to be used, and what countries were unwitting and frankly didn't know the electronic packets passed through. So attribution, we talk about that a lot in the cyber realm, but I think in the broader hybrid conflicts, it may more and more come to pass. When is a non-state's actor, whether it's a ship taking a particular action or a boat in the middle of the South China Sea, you know, testing another country's claims, and it looks like a commercial vessel. It looks like, you know, a ship that might be flagged in a particular state, but certainly isn't a military vessel or a state vessel. At what point does that fishing trawler's actions can I attribute to the state itself? And I think that'll play out in the Ukraine. I think it'll play out in Syria with Yemen and some of the things that are going on there and so forth. It's always going to be a question of what gets attributed back to a state. And then if I can attribute it, what actions can I actually take against a state? That's what the clients, I think, are going to ask in this realm. And so I did a lot of thinking about that. The other thing I think I don't know that I learned, but that I got more questions about and I need to think through more is the whole question of when do you become a party to a conflict? And when does state responsibility attach to a state for different actions that you do? When you train and equip a force, for example, to do something, to move against another non-state actor, or to move against a state? When do you, you know, when does state responsibility attach? When do you become a party to a conflict? And I think we have some more thinking to do on that.
So, this are you guys now in the business of? I mean, you mentioned that cyber was too new to be a classic. What about joint staff symposia? Are you going to be doing more of these?
I think we are. I mean, first of all, I turn over my job the same day the chairman of the Joint Chiefs turn over.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
And we'll get to that. But so it's not going to be my decision. But I've encouraged my successor to be that this is something we ought to keep in the wheelhouse. This is something we ought to do because it was some work. But frankly, I think it was a nice change of pace for us to pull a little bit back from day to day operations and say, let's think deep, let's think forward, let's look to the future a little bit and think about the law and get some really smart people in the room to help us think. And it was just a nice way to spend 2 days. And so I think we're going to do more of these. And I think this formula seemed to work pretty well. Pick a cutting edge topic that our clients care about, and let's delve into it, the legal aspects of it, and to a smaller degree, the policy aspects of it, because we get asked about that as well. And so, you know, you might see one in the near term, probably in the next maybe year or two. It depends on Rear Admiral Crandall. But you might see one on robotics or autonomous weapons, or it might be on cyber, although I think that one's been done quite a bit. And to me, if we're going to do one, we ought to do one that's a little bit different than nobody's done yet. And I think part of the reason we had such a turnout today was that everybody said, oh, hybrid conflicts, what's that? Did a quick search online, found that, yes, people are talking about it, people are writing about it, and decided, you know, I want to be, this, as far as I know, maybe the first legal conference on the topic. And so I think if we keep that formula, we'll see crowds return.
So you mentioned you are stepping down at the end of the month, but before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about your office and what it does. I mean, you've alluded to the sort of triage function, but you guys are different from the Office of General Counsel, the Defense Department. What's the kind of division of labor between you guys and OGC?
No, that's a great question. You know, the main principal difference, obviously, is different client. I mean, they exist to advise the Secretary of Defense, the undersecretaries, the assistant secretaries of defense, and the office of the secretary. I mean, they work to advise them. The folks on the third deck, as we say, the people, if you're in the Pentagon, they're on the third deck, primarily. And then our client is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, my client by statute, and then we also advise the vice chairman and the rest of the joint staff. And then I think we also, to a degree, I advise the Joint Chiefs of Staff when they meet as a body. I mean, when they're in the tank and they meet as a group and there are legal issues, I'm typically brought in to answer any questions that come up at that time. When they go back to their respective offices, the Chief of Staff in the Army looks to the Army Judge Advocate General for his legal advice, not to me, but when they're meeting as a body. So I think what makes us different is we're the last group of military attorneys who look over operational details before it goes to the Secretary of Defense for approval, or before it goes from the Secretary, if approved, to the President for approval in the chain of command.
So it's a more operational,
very
focused
operational
office.
Very operational. I only have 12 attorneys who work here in the Pentagon, and I'm one of them. And we're, you know, of those, 5 are doing operational things full time. The others are also involved in operations, but it's less of the day to day and more of the outward looking. So I have a detainee law expert, and detainee law and policy. I have someone who looks at multilateral treaties, who is responsible for ICRC, International Committee of the Red Cross dealings, and any issues that go on there. I have an attorney who looks at the bilateral treaty practice and will often go with the State Department and General Counsel's office upstairs on negotiations or about treaties. And then, of course, I have a few attorneys who help me focus on the the more day-to-day administrative type legal issues that any law office has, particularly in the military, the ethics questions. We have to comply with the Joint Ethics Regulation for the Department of Defense, and so I've got general officers on the joint staff who will say, "Can I accept this gift? Can I go to this particular event and speak? Can I be the president of this particular non-federal entity association?" And then we answer those questions for them. So we do some of that as well, but we are very, very operationally focused and lean. So if you go to the Office of General Counsel, for example, they have multiple lawyers who work solely on habeas corpus cases. You have an entire shop that deals with litigation. I have one attorney, her portfolio includes litigation.
Right.
You have attorneys who upstairs, you have multiple attorneys who work on Freedom of Information Act and Privacy Act. I have one attorney whose portfolio includes Freedom of Information Act. And so, you know, that's why I describe it as triage. When we get an action from the combatant commands, and that's where our actions primarily come from. They don't come from the services. So if the Army has a legal issue, it typically passes from the Army up to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And so it'll go through the Army TJAG's office, Army General Counsel's office, and then OGC up in DOD. Whereas if it comes from a COCOM, it comes through my office to DOD OGC. And so we're more involved with typically those operational type issues.
So there's going to be a transition. You're stepping down. What comes next for you? And tell us about your successor.
Well, first about my successor. It's Rear Admiral Dell Crandall, who's a Navy judge advocate who's he's actually worked in this office before. He's worked at European Command, UCOM. He worked on the National Security Council staff legal. He was the DOD's representative, worked there for a year. So great, great choice, I think. I had nothing to do with that. We actually, the statute that establishes this position, 10 U.S.C., Section 10, U.S. Code 156, Section 156, requires a board. And so it's really a unique board. It's the only one of its kind. It's a joint board, so all the services participate. There's the president of the board is a three-star selected from the joint staff, and they consider candidates from all the services, and you get the rank of one star and the position of legal counsel from the board. I mean, the board recommends that. It then goes to the Secretary of Defense. He sends it to the president. President, of course, makes the nomination. It goes to the Senate for confirmation, and then if confirmed, that individual is the legal counsel and now a one star. And so Dell Crandall was the one selected by the board. He's a great choice. I'm excited to see him come in. They're in tough competition. Some amazing, I know a lot of amazing judge advocates from all the various services who were equally as competitive. And so that was a tough choice. And I'm not sure how the board made it, but you know, I think they've done well. And I didn't have anything to do with that. So
how about you? You're retiring.
I am. You know, there's just not much for me to do as a one star. You know, this is kind of a pinnacle job for me. I mean, if you think about it, where do you go from being the legal counsel of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the services? And so there aren't a lot of legal jobs at the flag officer rank in any of the services. And this, I have always kind of known that I was going to serve for 4 years with General Dempsey. And then when he left, I was going to leave with him. That's kind of been my plan, which has helped with, frankly, with closure for me, because I've always known this is, you know, I've had friends who on the joint staff and other places, you know, flag officers who get told, "Hey, listen, we're sorry, you're not moving any further and you need to be retired in 3 months," you know, and that's not a lot of closure. I've had closure. I've known it's coming. I don't know what's next. I'm getting nibbles. I'll say I've got some folks expressing some interest, and that's exciting. The one thing I know for certain is that, you know, I feel an obligation morally, not legally, the lawyer's quick to add, but I feel a moral obligation to stay in this space. To, you know, I've had the privilege of working national security law issues and working international humanitarian law issues and having some great experiences with Joint Special Operations Command and ISAF and conventional Army units and special operations Army units and a combatant command. You know, I was at CENTCOM and now 4 years as chairman of legal. And I've had the privilege of being able to see so much from all of these jobs, but in particular this last one. And so I feel an obligation to stay in this space. I feel like I owe it. I'm not done. There ought to be things that I do with national security law and do with international humanitarian law and human rights law. And so that, you know, that may be teaching, that may be writing, that may be, you know, presenting at future symposium or conferences or staying involved with the ABA National Security Committee or, you know, working overseas. I've had a number of folks in Geneva and others who've said, hey, we'd like you to consider working on these projects related to law of armed conflict. And, you know, I think I'm going to stay in that space and keep working in these areas.
Well, as you have stuff to write, we hope you'll write them for Lawfare.
Well, Lawfare, of course.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
I appreciate
it.
On the conference.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any way you can. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.